Side 11. October 22nd. A fortnight today. I've marked the days on the side of the screen like Robinson Crusoe. I feel depressed. Sleepless. I must escape! I'm getting so pale. I feel ill, weak all the time. This terrible silence. He's so without mercy. So incomprehensible. What does he want? What is to happen? He must see I'm getting ill. I told him this evening that I must have some daylight. I made him look at me and see how pale I am. Tomorrow. Tomorrow. He never says no outright. Today I've been thinking he could keep me here forever. It wouldn't be very long, because I die. It's absurd. It's diabolical. There's no way of escape. I've been trying to find loose stones again. I could dig a tunnel round the door. I could dig a tunnel right out. But it would have to be at least 20 feet long. All the earth. Being trapped inside it. I could never do it. I'd rather die. So it must be a tunnel round the door. But to do that, I must have time. I must be sure he's away for at least 6 hours. 3 for the tunnel, 2 to break through the outer door. I feel it's my best chance. I mustn't waste it. Spoil it through lack of preparation. I can't sleep. I must do something. I'm going to write about the first time I met GP. Caroline said, "Oh, this is Miranda, my niece," and went on, telling him odiously about me. One Saturday morning shopping in the village, and I didn't know where to look. Although I'd been wanting to meet him, she'd talked about him before. But once, I liked the way he treated her, coolly. Not trying to hide he was bored. Not giving way before her, like everyone else. She talked about him all the way home. I knew she was shocked by him, although she wouldn't admit it. The 2 broken marriages, and then the obvious fact that he didn't think much of her. So that I wanted to defend him from the beginning. Then meeting him walking on the heath, having wanted to meet him again, and being ashamed again. The way he walked, very self-contained. Not loosely. Such a nice old pilot coat. He said hardly anything. I knew he really didn't want to be with us, with Caroline, but he'd caught us up. He can't have spotted from behind who we were. He was obviously going the same way, and perhaps, I'm being vain, it was something that happened when Caroline was going on in her silly woman of advanced ideas way, just to look between us. I knew he was irritated, and he knew I was ashamed. So he went round Kenwood with us, and Caroline showed off. And she said in front of the Rembrandt, "Don't you think he got the teeniest bit bored halfway through? I mean, I never feel I feel what I ought to feel. You know?" And she gave him her stupid listen-to-me laugh. I was looking at him, and his face suddenly went minutely stiff, as if he'd been caught off guard. It wasn't done for me to see. It was the minutest change in the set of his mouth. He just gave her one look, almost amused, but his voice wasn't. It was icy cold. "I must go now. Goodbye." The goodbye was for me. It wrote me off. Or it said, "So you can put up with this." I mean, looking back on it, he seemed to be teaching me a lesson. I had to choose. Caroline's way or his. And he was gone. He didn't even answer. And Caroline was looking after him and shrugging and looking at me and saying, "Well, really?" I watched him go out. His hands in his pockets. I was red. Caroline was furious, trying to slide out of it. "He's always like that. He does it deliberately." Sneering at his painting all the way home. Second-rate Paul Nash. Ridiculously unfair. And me feeling so angry with her and sorry for her at the same time. I couldn't speak. I couldn't be sorry for her. But I couldn't tell her he was right. Between them, Caroline and M have every quality I hate in other women. I had a sort of despair for days afterwards, thinking how much of their rotten, pretentious blood I must have in me. Of course, there are times when I like Caroline, her briskness, her enthusiasm, her kindness, and even all the pretentiousness that's so horrid next to the real thing. Well, it's better than nothing. I used to think the world of her when she came to stay. I used to love staying with her. She backed me up when there was the great family war about my future. All that till I lived with her and saw through her, grew up, and being a hard young woman. Then, a week later, I ran into the lift of the tube, and he was the only other person there. I said, "Hello," too brightly. Went red again. He just nodded as if he didn't want to speak. And then at the bottom, it was vanity. I couldn't bear to be lumped with Caroline. I said, "I'm sorry my aunt said that at Kenwood." He said, "She always irritates me." I knew he didn't want to talk about it. As we went towards the platforms, I said, "She's frightened of seeming behind the times." "Aren't you?" And he gave me one of his dry little smiles. I thought, he doesn't like me playing at us against her. We were passing a film poster, and he said, "That's a good film. Have you seen it?" "Do." When we came out on the platform, he said, "Come round one day, but leave your bloody aunt at home." And he smiled, a little infectious, mischievous smile. Not his age at all. Then he walked off. So by himself. So indifferent. So I did go round, one Saturday morning. He was surprised. I had to sit in silence for 20 minutes with him and the weird Indian music. He got straight back onto the divan and lay with his eyes shut, as if I shouldn't have come. And I felt I ought never to have come, especially without telling C. And I felt as well that it really was a bit much, a pose. I couldn't relax. At the end, he asked me about myself, curtly, as if it was all rather a bore. And I stupidly tried to impress him, do the one thing I shouldn't, show off. I kept on thinking he didn't really mean me to come round. Suddenly, he cut me short and took me round the room and made me look at things. His studio, the most beautiful room. I always feel happy there, everything in harmony, everything expressing only him. It's not deliberate, he hates interior decoration and gimmicks and vogue, but it's all him. Toinette, with her silly female house and garden ideas of austere good taste, calling it cluttered, could have bitten her head off. The feeling that someone lives all his life in it, works in it, thinks in it, is it. And we thawed out. I stopped trying to be clever. He showed me how he gets his haze effect. Tonksing gouache, with all his little homemade tools. Some friends of his came in, Barber and Francis Cruikshank. He said, "This is Miranda Gray. I can't stand her aunt." All in one breath. And they laughed. They were old friends. I wanted to leave. But they were going for a walk. They'd come in to make him go with them, and they wanted me to go too. Barber Cruikshank did. He had special seduction eyes for me. "Supposing Aunt sees us," said G.P. "Barbara's got the foulest reputation in Cornwall." I said, "She's my aunt, not my duenna." So we all went to the Vale of Health pub and then on to Kenwood. Francis told me about their life in Cornwall, and I felt for the first time in my life that I was among people of an older generation that I understood. Real people. And at the same time, I couldn't help seeing Barbara was a bit of a sham. All those funny, malicious stories. While G.P. was the one who led us into all the serious things. I don't mean that he wasn't gay, too. Only he has this strange twist of plunging straight into what matters. Once, when he was away getting drinks, Barbara asked me how long I'd known G.P. Then he said, "I wish to God I'd met someone like G.P. when I was a student." And quiet little Francis said, "We think he's the most wonderful person. He's one of a few." She didn't say which few, but I knew what she meant. At Kenwood, G.P. made a split. He took me straight to the Rembrandt and talked about it without lowering his voice. And I had the smallness to be embarrassed because some other people there stared at us. I thought, we must look like father and daughter. He told me all about the background to the picture. What Rembrandt probably felt like at that time, what he was trying to say, how he said it. As if I knew nothing about art. As if he was trying to get rid of a whole cloud of false ideas I probably had about it. We went out to wait for the others. He said, "That picture moves me very much." And he looked at me, as if he thought I might laugh. One of those flashes of shyness he has. I said, "It moves me now, too." But he grinned. "Can't possibly. Not for years yet." "How do you know?" He said, "I suppose there are people who are purely moved by great art. I never met a painter who was. I'm not. All I think of when I see that picture is that it has the supreme mastery I've spent all my life trying to attain, and shall not, ever. You're young. You can understand, but you can't feel that yet." I said, "I think I do." He said, "Then that's bad. You should be blind to failure at your age." And then he said, "Don't try to be our age. I shall despise you if you do." He said, "You're like a kid, trying to see over a 6-foot wall." That was the first time. He hated me for attracting him. The Professor Higgins side of him. Later, when the Crookshanks came out, he said, as they walked towards us, "Barber's a womanizer. Refuse to meet him if he asks." I gave him a surprised look. He said, smiling at them, "Not you. I can't stand the pain for Francis." Back in Hampstead, I left them and went on home. All the way back there, I realized the GP was making sure Barbara Cruikshank and I shouldn't be left alone. They, Barbara, asked me to come and see them if I was ever in Cornwall. GP said, "See you one day," as if he didn't care whether he did or not. I told Caroline I'd met him by chance. He had said he was sorry. Lie. If she'd rather I didn't see him, I wouldn't. But I found him very stimulating to be with, full of ideas. I needed to meet such people. It was too bad of me. I knew she would do the decent thing if I put it like that. I was my own mistress, and so on. And then she said, "Darling, you know I'm the last person to be approved, but his reputation. There must be fire. There's so much smoke." I said, "I'd heard about it. I could look after myself." "It's her own fault. She shouldn't insist on being called Caroline and treated like a girl in so many ways. I can't respect her as an aunt, as a giver of advice." Everything's changing. I keep on thinking of him, of things he said and I said, and how we neither of us really understood what the other meant. No, he understood, I think. He counts possibilities so much faster than I can. I'm growing up so quickly down here, like a mushroom. Or is it that I've lost my sense of balance? Perhaps it's all a dream. I jab myself with the pencil. But perhaps that's a dream, too. If he came to the door now, I should run into his arms. I should want him to hold my hand for weeks. I mean, I believe I could love him in the other way, his way, now. October 23rd. The curse is with me. I'm a bitch to see. No mercy. It's the lack of privacy on top of everything else. I made him let me walk in the cellar this morning. I think I could hear a tractor working and sparrows. So daylighty, sparrows. An aeroplane. I was crying. My emotions are all topsy-turvy, like frightened monkeys in a cage. I felt I was going mad last night, so I wrote and wrote and wrote myself into the other world. To escape in spirit, if not in fact. To prove it still exists. I've been making sketches for a painting I shall do when I'm free. A view of a garden through a door. It sounds silly in words, but I see it as something very special. All black, umber, dark, dark grey. Mysterious angular forms in shadow leading to the distant soft honey whitish square of the light-filled door. A sort of horizontal shaft. I sent him away after supper, and I've been finishing Emma. I am Emma Woodhouse. I feel for her, of her, and in her. I have a different sort of snobbism, but I understand her snobbism, her priggishness. I admire it. I know she does wrong things. She tries to organize other people's lives. She can't see Mr. Knightley as a man in a million. She's temporarily silly. Yet all the time one knows she's basically intelligent, alive, creative, determined to set the highest standards, a real human being. Her faults are my faults. Her virtues, I must make my virtues. And all day I've been thinking. I shall write some more about GP tonight. There was a time I took some of my work round for him to look at. I took the things I thought he would like, not just the clever, clever things like the perspective of Ladymont. He didn't say a thing as he looked through them, even when he was looking at the ones like the Carmen at Ivinghoe that I think are my best, or did then. And at the end he said, "They're not much good, in my opinion, but a bit better than I expected." It was as if he had turned and hit me with his fist. I couldn't hide it. He went on, "It's quite useless if I think of your feelings in any way at all. I can see you're a draftsman, you've a fairy sense of colour and whatnot, sensitive, all that. But you wouldn't be at the Slade if you hadn't." I wanted him to stop, but he would go on. "You've obviously seen quite a lot of good painting. Tried not to plagiarise too flagrantly. But this thing of your sister, Kokoschka, a mile off." He must have seen my cheeks were red, because he said, "Is all this rather disillusioning? It's meant to be." It nearly killed me. I know he was right. It would have been ridiculous if he hadn't said exactly what he thought, if he'd just kind-uncled me. But it hurt. It hurt like a series of slaps across the face. I'd made up my mind that he would like some of my work. What made it worse was his coldness. He seemed so absolutely serious and clinical. Not the faintest line of humour or tenderness, even of sarcasm on his face. Suddenly much, much older than me. He said, "One has to learn that painting well, in the academic and technical sense, comes right at the bottom of the list. I mean, you've got that ability, so have thousands. But the thing I look for isn't here. Just isn't here." And then he said, "I know this hurts. As a matter of fact, I nearly asked you not to bring this round, but then I thought, well, there's a sort of eagerness about you. You'd survive." "You knew they wouldn't be any good?" I said. "I expected just about this. Shall we forget you brought them?" But I knew he was challenging me. I said, "Tell me in detail what is wrong with this." And I gave him one of the street scenes. He said, "Quite graphic, well composed. I can't tell you details, but it's not living art. It's not a limb of your body. I don't expect you to understand this at your age. It can't be taught you. You either have it one day or you don't. They're teaching you to express personality at the Slade, personality in general. But however good you get at translating personality into line or paint, it's no go if your personality isn't worth translating. All luck. Pure hazard." He spoke in fits and starts, and there was a silence. I said, "Shall I tear them up?" And he said, "Now you're being hysterical." I said, "I've got so much to learn." He got up and said, "I think you've got something in you." "Ah, I don't know. Women very rarely have. I mean, most women just want to be good at something. They've got good at minds. And they mean deftness and a flair, and good taste and whatnot. They can't ever understand that if your desire is to go to the furthest limits of yourself, then the actual form your art takes doesn't seem important to you. Whether you use words or paint or sounds, what you will." I said, "Go on." He said, "It's rather like your voice. You put up with your voice and speak with it because you haven't any choice. But it's what you say that counts. It's what distinguishes all great art from the other kind. The technically accomplished buggers are two a penny in any period, especially in this great age of universal education." He was sitting on his divan, talking at my back. I had to stare out of the window. I thought I was going to cry. He said, "Critics spiel away about technical accomplishment. Absolutely meaningless, that sort of jargon. Art's cruel. You can get away with murder with words, but a picture is like a window straight through to your inmost heart. And all you've done here is build a lot of little windows onto a heart full of other fashionable artist paintings. He came and stood beside me and picked out one of the new abstracts I'd done at home. You're saying something here about Nicholson or Passmore, not about yourself. You're using a camera. Just as trompe-l'œil is mischanneled photography, so is painting in someone else's style. You're photographing here, that's all.
I'll never learn, I said.
It's to unlearn, he said. You've nearly finished the learning. The rest is luck. No, a little more than luck. Courage, patience. We talked for hours. He talked, and I listened. It was like wind and sunlight. It blew all the cobwebs away, shone on everything. Now I write down what he said. It seems so obvious. But it's something in the way he says things. He's the only person I know who always seems to mean what he says when he talks about art. If one day you found he didn't, it would be like blasphemy. And there is the fact that he is a good painter, and I know he'll be quite famous one day. And this influences me more than it should. Not only what he is, what he will be. I remember later he said, Professor Higgins again, you don't really stand a dog's chance anyhow. You're too pretty. The art of love's your line, not the love of art. I'm going to the heath to drown myself, I said. Shouldn't marry. Have a tragic love affair. Have your ovaries cut out. Something. But he gave me one of his really wicked looks out of the corners of his eyes. It wasn't just that. It was frightened in a funny little boy way, too. As if he'd said something he knew he shouldn't have, to see how I would react. And suddenly he seemed much younger than me. He so often seems young in a way I can't explain. Perhaps that he's made me look at myself and see that what I believe is old and stuffy. People who teach you cram old ideas, old views, old ways into you. Like covering plants with layer after layer of old earth. It's no wonder the poor things so rarely come up fresh and green. The GP has. I didn't recognize it as fresh green shootiness for a long time. But now I do. October 24th. Another bad day. I made sure it was bad for Caliban, too. Sometimes he irritates me so much I could scream at him. It's not so much the way he looks, though that's bad enough. He's always so respectable. His trousers always have creases. His shirts are always clean. I really think he'd be happier if he wore starched collars. So utterly not with it. And he stands. He's the most tremendous stander around I've ever met. Always with that I'm sorry expression on his face, which I begin to realize is actually contentment. The sheer joy of having me under his power, of being able to spend all and every day staring at me. He doesn't care what I say or how I feel. My feelings are meaningless to him. It's the fact that he's got me. I could scream abuse at him all day long. He wouldn't mind at all. It's me he wants, my look, my outside. Not my emotions or my mind or my soul or even my body. Not anything human. He's a collector. That's the great dead thing in him. What irritates me most about him is his way of speaking. Cliché after cliché after cliché. And all so old-fashioned as if he'd spent all his life with people over 50. At lunchtime today, he said, I called in with regard to those records they placed on order. I said, why don't you just say I asked about those records you ordered? He said, I know my English isn't correct, but I'll try to make it correct. I didn't argue. That sums him up. He's got to be correct. He's got to do whatever was right and nice before either of us were born. I know it's pathetic. I know he's a victim of a miserable, non-conformist suburban world and a miserable social class, the horrid, timid, copycatting, genteel, in-between class. I used to think D&M's class the worst, all golf and gin and bridge and cars and the right accent and the right money and having been to the right school and hating the arts, the theatre being a pantomime at Christmas and hay fever by the town rep, Picasso and Bartok, dirty words unless he wanted to get a laugh. Well, that is foul, but Caliban's England is fouler. Makes me sick. The blindness, deadness, out of dateness, stodginess, and yes, sheer jealous malice of the great bulk of England. GP talks about the Paris rat, not being able to face England anymore. I understand that so well. The feeling that England stifles and smothers and crushes like a steamroller over everything fresh and green and original. And that's what causes tragic failures like Matthew Smith and Augustus John. They've done the Paris rat, and they live ever after in the shadow of Gauguin and Matisse, or whoever it may be. Just as GP says he once lived under the shadow of Braque, and suddenly woke up one morning to realize that all he'd done for 5 years was a lie, because it was based on Braque's eyes and sensibilities and not his own. Photography. It's all because there's so little hope in England that you have to turn to Paris or somewhere abroad. But you have to force yourself to accept the truth that Paris is always an escape downwards. GP's words. Not saying anything against Paris, but you have to face up to England and the apathy of the environment. These are all GP's words and ideas. And the great dead weight of the Calibanity of England. And the real saints are people like Moore and Sutherland, who fight to be English artists in England. Like Constable and Palmer and Blake. Another thing I said to Caliban the other day, we were listening to jazz. I said, "Don't you dig this?" And he said, "In the garden." I said he was so square he was hardly credible. "Oh, there," he said. "Like rain. Endless, dreary rain. Colour-killing." I've forgotten to write down the bad dream I had last night. I always seem to get them at dawn. Something to do with the stuffiness of this room after I've been locked in it for a night. The relief when he comes and the door is open and the fan on. I've asked him to let me go straight out and breathe the cellar air, but he always makes me wait till I've had breakfast. As I think he might not let me have my half hour in mid-morning if he let me go out earlier. I don't insist. The dream was this. I'd done a painting. I can't really remember what it was like, but I was very pleased with it. It was at home. I went out, and while I was out, I knew something was wrong. I had to get home. When I rushed up to my room, Em was there, sitting at the Pembroke table. Minnie was standing by the wall looking frightened. I think GP was there too, and other people for some peculiar reason. And the picture was in shreds. Great, long strips of canvas. And Em was stabbing at the tabletop with her secateurs, and I could see she was white with rage. And I felt the same, the most wild rage and hatred. I woke up then. I've never felt such rage for Em. Even that day when she was drunk and hit me in front of that hateful boy, Peter Catesby. I can remember standing there with her slap on my cheek and feeling ashamed, outraged, shocked, everything. But sorry for her. I went and sat by her bed and held her hand and let her cry and forgave her and defended her with Daddy and Minnie. But this dream seemed so real, so terribly natural. I've accepted that she tried to stop me from becoming an artist. Parents always misunderstand their children. No, I won't misunderstand mine. I knew I was supposed to be the son and surgeon poor Dee never was able to be. Carmen will be that now. I mean, I've forgiven them their fighting against my ambition for their ambitions. I won, so I must forgive. But that hatred in that dream, it was so real. I don't know how to exercise it. I could tell it to GP, but there's only the slithery scratch of my pencil on this pad. Nobody who has not lived in a dungeon could understand how absolute the silence down there is. No noise unless I make it. So I feel near death. Buried. No outside noises to help me be living at all. Often I put on a record, not to hear music, but to hear something. I have a strange illusion quite often. I think I become deaf. I have to make a little noise to prove I'm not. I clear my throat to show myself that everything's quite normal. It's like the little Japanese girl they found in the ruins of Hiroshima. Everything dead. And she was singing to her doll. October 25th. I must escape. I spent hours and hours today thinking about it. Wild ideas. He's so cunning. It's incredible. Foolproof. It must seem I never try to escape. But I can't try every day. That's the trouble. I have to space out the attempts. And each day here is like a week outside. Violence is no good. I must be cunning. Face to face. I can't be violent. The idea makes me feel weak at the knees. I remember wandering with Donald somewhere in the East End after we'd been to the Whitechapel, and we saw a group of teddies standing around two middle-aged Indians. We crossed the street. I felt sick. The teddies were shouting, chivying and bullying them off the pavement onto the road. Donald said, "What can one do?" And we both pretended to shrug it off, to hurry away. But it was beastly. Their violence and our fear of violence. If he came to me now and knelt and handed me the poker, I couldn't hit him. No good. I've been trying to sleep for the last half hour and I can't. Writing here is a sort of drug. It's the only thing I look forward to. This afternoon I read what I wrote about GP the day before yesterday, and it seemed vivid. I know it seems vivid because my imagination fills in all the bits another person wouldn't understand. I mean, it's vanity. But it seems a sort of magic to be able to call my past back. And I just can't live in this present. I would go mad if I did. I've been thinking today of the time I took Piers and Antoinette to meet him. The black side of him. No, I was stupid. Stupid. They'd come up to Hampstead to have coffee, and we were to go to the Everyman, but the queue was too long. So I let them bully me into taking them round. It was vanity on my part. I talked too much about him, so that they began to hint that I couldn't be so very friendly if I was afraid to take them round to meet him. And I fell for it. I could see he wasn't pleased at the door, but he asked us up. And, oh, it was terrible. Terrible. Piers was at his slickest and cheapest, and Antoinette was almost parodying herself. She was so sex-kittenish. I tried to excuse everyone to everyone else. GP was in such a weird mood. I knew he could withdraw, but he went out of his way to be rude. He could have seen Piers was only trying to cover up his feeling of insecurity. They tried to get him to discuss his own work, but he wouldn't. He started to be outrageous. Four-letter words, all sorts of bitter, cynical things about the Slade and various artists, things I know he doesn't believe. He certainly managed to shock me and Piers, but of course, Antoinette just went one better. Simpered and trembled her eyelashes, and said something fouler still. So he changed tack. Cut us short every time we tried to speak, me too. And then I did something even more stupid than having gone there in the first place. There was a pause, and he obviously thought we would go. But I, idiotically, thought I could see Antoinette and Piers looking rather amused, and I was sure it was because they felt I didn't know him as well as I'd said. So I had to try to prove to them that I could manage him. I said, "Could we have a record, GP?" For a moment, he looked as if he would say no. But then he said, "Why not? Let's hear someone saying something for a change." He didn't give us any choice. He just went and put a record on. He lay on the divan with his eyes closed, as usual, and Piers and Antoinette obviously thought it was a pose. Such a thin, strange, quavering noise, and such a tense, awkward atmosphere had built up. I mean, it was the music on top of everything else. Piers started to smirk, and Antoinette had a fit of... She can't giggle. She's too slinky, her equivalent. And I smiled. I admit it. Piers cleaned out his ear with his little finger, and then leant on his elbow with his forehead on outstretched fingers, and shook his head every time the instrument, I didn't know what it was then, vibrated. Antoinette half-choked. It was awful. I knew he would hear. He did. He saw Piers cleaning his ears again. And Piers saw himself being seen and put on a clever sort of don't-mind-us smile. GP jumped up and turned off the player. He said, "You don't like it?" Piers said, "Have I got to like it?" I said, "Piers, that wasn't funny. Piers said, I wasn't making a noise, was I? Have we got to like it? GP said, get out. Antoinette said, I'm afraid I always think of Beecham. You know, two skeletons copulating on a tin roof. GP said, frightening his face, he can look devilish. First, I'm delighted that you should admire Beecham. A pompous little duck-assed bandmaster who stood against everything creative in the art of his time. Second, if you can't tell that from a harpsichord, Christ help you. Third, to Piers, I think you're the smuggest young layabout I've met for years, and you, me, are these your friends? I stood there. I couldn't say anything. He made me furious. They made me furious. And anyhow, I was 10 times more embarrassed than furious. Piers shrugged. Antoinette looked bewildered, but vaguely amused, the bitch, and I was red. It makes me red again to think of it, and of what happened later. How could he? Take it easy, said Piers. It's only a record. I suppose he was angry. He must have known it was a stupid thing to say. You think that's only a record? GP said. Is that it? It's just a record. Are you like this stupid little bitch's aunt? Do you think Rembrandt got the teeniest bit bored when he painted? Do you think Bach made funny faces and giggled when he wrote that? Do you? Piers looked deflated, almost frightened. Well, do you? Shouted GP. He was terrible, both ways. He was terrible because he'd started it all. He determined to behave in that way. And wonderfully terrible, because passion is something you never see. I've grown up among people who've always tried to hide passion. He was raw, naked, trembling with rage. Piers said, we're not as old as you are. It was pathetic, feeble. Showed him up for what he really is. Christ, said GP, art students. Art students. I can't write what he said next. Even Antoinette looked shocked. He just turned and went. The studio door slammed behind us when we were on the stairs. I hissed a damn you at Piers at the bottom and pushed them out. Darling, he'll murder you, said Antoinette. I shut the door and waited. After a moment, I heard the music again. I went up the stairs and very slowly opened the door. Perhaps he heard. I don't know. They didn't look up, and I sat on a stool near the door until it was finished. He said, what do you want, Miranda? I said, to say I'm sorry, and to hear you say you're sorry. He went and stared out of the window. I said, I know I was stupid. I may be little, but I'm not a bitch. He said, you try. I think he didn't mean you try to be a bitch. I said, you could have told us to go away. We would have understood. There was a silence. He turned to look at me across the studio. I said, I'm very sorry. He said, go home. We can't go to bed together. When I stood up, he said, I'm glad you came back. It was decent of you. And he said, you would. I went down the stairs and he came out behind me. I don't want to go to bed with you. I'm speaking about the situation, not us. Understand? I said, of course I understand. And I went on down, being female, wanting to make him feel I was hurt. As I opened the bottom door, he said, I've been hitting it. He must have seen I didn't understand because he added drinking. He said, I'll telephone you. He did. He took me to a concert to hear the Russians play Shostakovich. And he was sweet. That's just what he was, even though he never apologized. October 26th. I don't trust him. He's bought this house. If he lets me go, he'll have to trust me. Or he'll have to sell it and disappear before I can, could get to the police. Either way, it would be unlike him. It's too depressing. I have to believe he'll keep his word. He spends pounds and pounds on me. It must be nearly 200 already. Any book, any record, any clothes. He has all my sizes. I sketch what I want. I mix up the colours as a guide. He even buys all my underwear. I can't put on the black and peach creations he bought before. So I told him to go and get something sensible at Marks and Spencer. He said, "Can I buy a lot together?" Of course, it must be agony for him to go shopping for me. What does he do at the chemist's? So I suppose he prefers to get it all over in one go. But what can they think of him? 1 dozen pants and 3 slips and vests and bras. I asked him what they said when he gave the order and he went red. "I think they think I'm a bit peculiar," he said. It was the first time I've really laughed since I came here. Every time he buys me something, I think it's proof that he's not going to kill me or do anything else unpleasant. I shouldn't, but I like it when he comes in at lunchtime from wherever he goes. There are always parcels. It's like having a perpetual Christmas day and not even having to thank Santa Claus. Sometimes he brings things I haven't asked for. He always brings flowers, and that's nice. Chocolates, but he eats more of them than I do. And he keeps on asking me what I'd like him to buy. I know he's the devil showing me the world that can be mine, so I don't sell myself to him. I cost him a lot in little things, but I know he wants me to ask for something big. He's dying to make me grateful. But he shan't. End of side 11.